Welcome to the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow from KERA in Dallas, Texas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us tonight. We are here, as I said, at KERA in front of a live audience talking about the election. And elections are, as you know, about a lot of things, but often they come down to one fairly simple thing. So, stop me if you've heard this before. Let's do the numbers. We have 21 days until the election, and your state, Texas, is the number two prize when it comes to electoral votes. And lucky for you, you don't matter at all. No, that's not true. I'm joking. You really do. But it does kind of seem like it's all swing states all the time, doesn't it? Still, there is a silver lining. You don't have the pleasure of those wall-to-wall, completely honest, highly complimentary super PAC ads from the groups that really sound like a workout video. Restore Our Future, Joe Sixpack, Feel the Heat, Restore USA, all of those. But let me ask you this. What do you think of when you hear these voices?
We can choose a future where we export more products and outsource fewer jobs. After a decade that was defined by what we bought and borrowed, we're getting back to basics and doing what America's always done best. We are making things again.
That America, that united America, can unleash an economy that will put Americans back to work, that will once again lead the world with innovation and productivity, and that will restore every father and mother's confidence that their children's future is brighter even than the past.
You know what I love about that piece of tape, and we've done this show a couple of times now? How similar those two guys sound, right? They're saying almost exactly the same thing. Governor Romney, obviously, and President Obama. Elections usually have a theme: national security, foreign affairs. This time around, it is the economy, jobs, taxes, the deficit, the middle class. But what's even more important is the story behind all of those things. And that's why we're here today, taking the time to explain what often gets passed along just as talking points. This election is about so many things that are so much more important than who's ahead, in which poll, by how much. It's not, as the sign says, the horse race that matters. It is the economy, stupid. So tonight, the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. Stick around. Dancing. That's awesome. So here's something we have heard over and over again, ever since really the financial crisis nearly brought down the global financial system, that the government should be running the economy more efficiently, more like a business. That's one of the big arguments that Governor Romney is making as part of his candidacy. He is, as we all know, a former business leader, a CEO, and he draws attention to President Obama's lack of experience in that world out on the stump.
When I became governor of Massachusetts, I took the skills I'd learned in business and went to look at our state budget. We were about $3 billion out of balance. I actually cut spending dollars in Massachusetts, and we balanced our budget and went from a $3 billion budget gap in my first year to over $2 billion rainy day fund.
So on the face of it, it sounds pretty reasonable, right? Any economy is all about bringing in revenue and then spending it judiciously. It's the root cause of our debate that we're having right now about debt and the deficit, the fiscal cliff that's coming at year's end. But does it stand to reason that the running of an economy, that is essentially the running of a government, should be more like a business? Patty Hirsch is the brains behind our popular online explainer, the Marketplace Whiteboard. He is author of the new book. It's called Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained, and that's what he's here to do tonight. Patty, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, so here's why you get the big money, pal. You ready?
I'm ready. Can I do a little drawing? Is that
you
okay?
Can do some drawing. Drawing would be good. The Marketplace Whiteboard,
all right?
Business versus an economy. Should they be alike? Are they? Help me out.
Well, there are some similarities, of course, right? So let me, here's one I drew earlier.
Good.
So we have a factory here and we have the capital.
Yep.
So whenever we look at these two entities and we think about leadership, well, they are kind of similar in that, you know, you've got these entities that, you know, both make money, right?
Yep.
In an economy and in the government, we make money by levying taxes, and so you get money in the door that way. In a company, you make money by selling things, and so revenue comes in the door. And, of course, you have expenditure in both cases. In a company, you have money going out the door because we pay wages, and, of course, we have to buy stuff in order to make stuff. And in an economy, in a government, we're spending on these government programs. And a good leader, whether you be a CEO of a company or whether you be the president of an economy, will do their best to balance the budget. And in good times, that's a relatively easy thing to do. You've got money coming in, you've got money going out, but the economy is turning over quite nicely, and what you're looking for is that balanced position. So
key phrase there, in good times?
In good times, exactly. Okay, because right. So good times, right. Relatively easy. Bad times, that's when it starts to get a little tricky. And this is when the comparison between running a business and running a government starts to break down. Because
all right, lay it out.
If you're running, same pictures.
Same, right? We've got a factory, people, capital building, people.
Right?
Good.
So if you're whether you're running an economy or whether you're running a government or whether you're running a business, in bad times, you're getting less money going into the door. It's going through the door, right? You're selling less. You're selling less if you're a company, so there's less revenue.
Yep.
You're gaining less in taxes if you're in a running a government, so there's less money coming in that way. But your spending remains the same in most cases because as a company, you've still got to pay your workers. You've still got to buy product in order to make product. And in an economy, of course, in a government, you've still got these government programs that you have to keep funding, so you're still spending. So you've got to make some cuts.
Yep.
And if you're running a company, those cuts are relatively easy. Well, for a start, you can get rid of a bunch of these workers.
Hey, right? No, those are people.
Sorry, we got to get rid of those guys.
You heartless.
Well, you know. Say for example.
Sorry.
That's the way it is. We got to cut some costs here. Say you're making cars and trucks. You might say to yourself, you know what? We don't want to make trucks anymore. Let's get rid of the trucks. All right. So we're just going to make cars. You can just cut a product line like that.
Yep.
You could conceivably say, you know what? Let's just change direction. Instead of making cars and trucks, let's make, I don't know, airplanes.
Wow.
Conceivably, you could do this if you're running a company. If you're running a government, it's a lot less difficult to do that. Cutting workers' salaries,
no,
difficult to do.
Yep.
As for product lines, I mean, the product lines in a government, of course, are things like, you know, Medicare, Social Security. More than 50% of government spending in this country goes on these large mandatory programs like Social Security, like Medicare, which cannot be cut wholesale. You can't just get rid of them in the way you could get rid of your truck business if you were a CEO. All right, so that's a big issue. So you've got this discretionary spending. You know, what about the stuff that we are allowed to cut? Stuff, unimportant stuff like, you know, I don't know, education, I don't know, defense spending, the Coast
how does
Guard.
That go? Let me know how that goes.
Get rid of that. So now you can start to see the difficulty whenever times are bad, the danger of making a comparison between running a business and running a government.
What about the person who's making these decisions, the CEO and the chief executive, if you will?
I'm glad you brought that because I have another little picture here.
Shocking.
Here's a CEO here on one side. Yes, she's a female CEO, and I'm afraid a male president. That's going to change.
Did you do that hair thing by yourself?
All
right.
Fancy work with the scissors there.
I'm just saying.
So you'll notice that the CEO has a particularly unhappy face, whereas the president's got a big smiley face.
The haircut.
Well, the haircut has certainly something to do with it. If you think of both a CEO and a president as leaders of a sort of a pyramidical organization, right? So the top of a pyramid, a CEO can walk around that pyramid, can walk around the company and say, hey, you in sales, start doing things this way. Hey, you in the postal department, you start doing things this way. We're going to change this. We're going to change that. And everybody's going to say, yes, ma'am, because she's the boss, right? The president walks around the House of Representatives and the Senate and starts telling people what to do.
Get to know her.
I don't think so. They're going to make gestures, okay?
and not ones you can repeat on a family radio
show.
That's right.
We don't report to you. We report to the people. So therefore, a CEO can have any aspect that they want. She can walk around and be gloomy. She can be unhappy. She can start bossing people around. She doesn't have to have much of a manner. She's in charge.
Right.
A president, on the other hand, has to have diplomacy, has to have, you know, the ability to persuade, to cajole, to, you know, to caress people in the way that he or she wants them to go. Hey, it's absolutely necessary. Yeah. This is all part of diplomacy. So making the, and this is particularly true during bad times, making the comparison between a business leader and the leader of a nation is actually a pretty poor comparison because whenever people are saying, well, we want someone to run this government like a business, you really wouldn't want that business being, or your government being run that way.
But it's working though, isn't it? Out there on the polls, isn't it?
Well, it's
a little bit.
It's certainly true that Mitt Romney has both run a government and run a business. However, he was running that government in good times.
Yeah.
And what it really comes down to is how good that president's power of diplomacy is going to be whenever, you know, the rubber meets the road, the times are hard, and you are going to have to make those cuts.
Patty Hirsch, she does the Marketplace Whiteboard. His book is called Man Versus Markets, The Economy Explained. Patty, thanks.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Forget the debates and the back and forth and, yes, the horse race. This election is all about the economy, the direction in poll speak of whether we're on the right track or the wrong track. We have all been hearing for the past couple of years about monetary policy and quantitative easing and liquidity injections, or to sum it up in a word or a phrase, the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States of America. The Fed is, it's important to say, a nonpartisan organization, but it is one whose policy decisions do affect what we all experience economically. Richard Fisher is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Texas. He is also an occasional member of the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets those interest rates and decides those policies. Mr. Fisher, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. Thanks.
So I'm going to start with a fairly fundamental question. Is it really the economy this time around, do you think? I mean, do you agree with the premise?
I do, and I think our biggest problem is lack of jobs. We have massive unemployment. We're drowning in unemployment. And we're going to have to correct all these fiscal problems that were referred to earlier by Patty, and the difficult decisions have to be made by government, at the same time that we don't kill the very faint job-creating heartbeat that we have in this country right now.
Don't you find it kind of interesting, though, that every time Ben Bernanke goes to the Hill, every time the Federal Reserve speaks, which I know is a broad phrase, you guys, and I'll put you in that group, are seen as the saviors, man. Where you been?
We've been doing a lot. Now, I would argue we've been doing too much.
Too much, perhaps,
so you know.
Yeah.
But let me use a simple analogy for the audience. We can fill the gas tank. Mm-hmm. We cannot compel people to step on the accelerator or move the job-creating engine forward. You have to be incented to do that. And right now, we have copious amounts of cash sitting on the balance sheets of banks. They deposit them, by the way, in our Federal Reserve
banks. Yes, they do.
$1.4 trillion. Over $2 trillion sitting fallow on corporate balance sheets. And another.
Say that again. That's an amazing amount of money. $2
trillion. Over $2 trillion. So, plus, there are non-depository financial institutions, the funds, the money market funds, and so on, that have huge amounts, trillions of dollars, sitting on their balance sheets or in their accounts. We have made that possible. We've driven down interest rates to historic lows, the lowest in the history of the Republic of the United States, and even in your lifetime.
So 27 years.
Yeah, 27 years. Big deal.
Yeah. Crazy, I know.
And all the surveys show, whether it's small business, big business, public, or private, their biggest concern is not access to capital or the cost of money. So then the question is, why aren't they spending it to create jobs? And the answer, Kai, is enormous uncertainty. They don't know what their taxes are going to be. They don't know what federal spending is going to be. How will the fiscal cliff, as they call it, be treated? And in the treatment of that, which we know from what's called a macroeconomic standpoint, very critical, how will it either discourage or encourage people from going out to hire? And with that uncertainty, people go into a defensive crouch.
Well, so let me ask you this then. I mean, everybody has been saying, oh, you know, let's get through the election, and then we're going to have some certainty no matter who wins, and it'll be either four more years or four new years, and it'll be taken care of. Do you buy that?
Well, I think Patty made a good point.
He always
does. To me, oh, I know he's a great guy. Makes always good points. The real key is not, I mean, we have two good men vying for the presidency. We're totally neutral to Fed, as you know. The real question is how they can work with the people that collect our taxes, make the decisions to spend. That's the Congress of the United States.
Yeah.
And my own personal view is for far too long, both Republicans and Democrats have driven us up to the cliff and, in fact, have buried our children and our grandchildren in debt and obligations. They're going to have to figure out a way to do things right and reboot tax and spending policy to incent people to create jobs.
We're going to have a rare opportunity for you guys to ask questions of the president of Dallas Fed in about 2 or 3 minutes. Come up to that front microphone in the light if you want to, and we'll get you in here. Let me ask you, though. The chairman said 6-8 weeks ago on the Hill, he said, I hope the Congress will fix the fiscal cliff. I believe the Congress will fix the fiscal cliff. When you guys are sitting around that big boardroom in the Fed building in Washington, are you guys talking about this stuff?
Sure, because we're worried about what kind of depressing effect it would have if suddenly taxes went through the roof and spending went way, way down, or defense spending was sequestered. We have to understand the macroeconomic impact.
Right.
But here's the real issue. Even if they have a fix, short-term or long-term, most important thing is that they don't have a long-term fix, they have a short-term fix. Let's say they plug this fiscal cliff or deal with it for 9 months or 1 year.
Yeah.
The businesswomen and men of America will have enormous uncertainty what's going to happen after that, and I think they'll just hold back for that 9 months or 1 year. And what we're worried about, because we're mandated by Congress to deal with it, price stability, prices are fairly
inflation.
Stable right now,
but
we're also mandated to create the monetary conditions to create full employment. We got a long, long, long way to go.
Come on up to the mic, ask him a question. I've had several economists say to me in the past 3 or 4 years, you know what? 7.5-8% unemployment, that's the way it's going to be. Just get used to it.
Well, what they're talking about is, in economist terms, structural unemployment. Yep. I don't accept that.
Wow.
Because we have a great dynamic society. Education plays a role, as was mentioned earlier. There's so many things that play a role. But we have the most productive society in the history of the world. We have the greatest mix of people that get things done. And you're in the right place, Kai, because Texas is a good example for everybody.
Well, I mean, you look around, right?
We are the job-creating machine of America.
That's right. Unemployment here is low. I mean, Dallas is booming. Mm-hmm. What are you guys doing that the rest of the world can copy?
We have the same, let me just make the point, we have the same monetary policy of the 49
states. That's true. Great point.
Same interest rates, all these good people pay, same C&I loan rates
so
and so
up?
On. Well, obviously, we have a different structure in sense business. We have a regulatory structure a little bit different. We don't have an income tax here. There are lots of things, and the only proof of that is to see where people vote with their feet. We have massive immigration into Texas among domestic border people and also people coming across the border and from elsewhere. If you look at California, Kai, you'll see an exodus.
Oh, tell me about it.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
That's why you're here.
We see
that's
it all. That's
tonight.
Why we came.
Yeah, good.
In fact, actually,
like
what's happening, we're staying, actually. This is news to the whole audience, including my boss. But
you
Marketplace
see it in New York,
is coming to
you
Texas.
See it in Illinois. Right. And so whatever it is, we're doing something right.
Sir, tell us who you are and where you're from, please.
Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm from Denton. I was just wondering, what are some kinds of incentives that we as voters might be looking for from our candidates that would incentivize companies to start using some of that money that they've built up? I know you talked about that there's a large stash, but it kind of seems like we're just at the mercy of whoever holds that large stash. So how can we use our vote to start influencing that incentive?
Well, you own the Congress of the United States. The Congress writes the laws and the regulations that determine what they collect, as Patty said, what they take in, and what they put out, and also what the rules of the game are. So again, regardless who's president of the United States, you've got to get those people to provide the right incentives to take advantage of the cheap money the Fed's made available, and we have made money very cheap and widely abundant. And incent, your businesswoman, your businessman, small businesses, medium-sized businesses are the job creators in America, not mega corporations, but to put it to work. So they have to be incentivized to do it. They have to have the right tax structure. They have to take advantage of the spending patterns of government so that they direct it towards job making in America. And again, I want to remind everybody in this room, you people own these people. You vote for them. You determine who's in office. If you don't like where we're going, you just advocate for change. And you are in control.
We got small businesses coming up a little bit later on. Quickly, ma'am, if I could, who you are and where you're from in less than a minute.
Elizabeth Gaylord from Plano, Texas.
Yes, ma'am.
And I take issue with where the state of Texas is going. And my main point is the cost that we are, or the money that we are not spending, or what has been cut from education, and the jobs that we have created in the state of Texas, I would take issue, are not the type of jobs that I would like to see the future generation of Texas have, which are low-paying service jobs.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I agree with you on education, but...
last word, absolutely, go ahead.
But you're wrong on jobs. Just so you know, and it just doesn't work that way. If I had time, I could walk you through the composition. It's working. We do it better than anybody else, but we have a heck of a job to do on education, and we're not doing a very good job, and I agree with you on that point.
I appreciate both your points. Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Dallas Fed. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Take care. Coming up, two of the many things Dallas is known for, boots and buildings, the economics of a growing economy. Also, what the candidates aren't talking about, the silent issues that matter here in 2012. Stay with us for more of the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow coming up. That one's for you. All right, so this next segment is about shoes, not just any old pair of shoes, though. These scream American in every single way. The cowboy boot, of course. Hundreds of custom bootmakers in this country, including Justin Brands. They have been in business since 1879 making boots. That's 133 years. a whole lot of boots. Herb Beckwith is the CFO and Senior Vice President of International Operations at Justin Brands. Herb, thanks a lot. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Kai.
Appreciate it.
It should be a lot easier to talk to you, being you come to Texas. If you're wearing a pair of boots, I can speak to you a little easier.
If you have some in that bag right there,
I sure do. I'd like you to try these on.
I have to. Good. Lucky thing, though. I love those. Those are awesome.
I want you to notice the quality of those boots and the comfort while you're at it.
So, all right, so I have to tell you, I don't have the boot cut, so I'm going to look like some hick here. All right, first of all, these things are hard to get on.
I'll pop them in
How
there.
Do you guys do this every day? Jeans outside or inside?
Either way.
Outside. Outside, comma, you country hick, you. Where did this whole boot thing come from, anyway?
Huh?
I mean, you know, these are works of art. They're not shoes.
Yeah, they're gorgeous, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're nice. And you know what? Oh, wait. Wait.
I'll pop them in. There you go.
How they feel. They're comfortable, too.
How they feel.
So you know what's funny?
Yeah.
It almost makes me want to do a little line dance or something. Even though I don't really know how.
Well, that's the key about Western boots. You know, they you could be anything you want in a pair of boots. They're part of the American dream. You know, we're from 1879 up to now.
Yeah.
You could be a cowboy, John Wayne.
They make my feet look skinny for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, a little bit.
What goes into making a pair of these boots? I mean, this is a global trade operation here, right? You're the international guy.
Yes, it sure is.
So talk to me about that.
Well, what goes into it, these boots right here, basically there's 200 steps to manufacture these boots. We actually run 3 factories in the United States. We're one of the few companies that have been able to maintain production in the United States.
Say that again. Manufacturing in the United States.
We manufacture in the United States. That's what it is.
So when we hear President Obama and Governor Romney talking about jobs being sent overseas, we're not talking boot makers.
Well, there's a few jobs that go overseas, but most of the jobs we've been able to keep here. About half the production goes over for price boots because that's what the economy wants, but we're one of the few. We're probably the largest manufacturer still in the United States.
Do you have to have boot-cut jeans?
You can wear them without it. No, it looks pretty good.
Do these jeans look a little high.
No.
Do these boots make me look fat?
Yeah.
Right.
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm just kidding. How has you been with this company, what, 30 years?
30 years.
How has the boot business changed?
How has it changed? Well, the boot business was pretty much, back in the 80s, it was running off of Urban Cowboy, if you will.
Yeah, well. Which I liked. That was a good
one. Which I came in about then. And at that point, you went through some good times. Our boot business runs kind of counter, if you will, to the economy. Economy's up. We kind of just move along, grow a little bit. Economy's down. We do a little better.
Now these are nice boots. They're black leather with some silver and gold machine stitching.
In this case,
yes. These are what you might well call a discretionary item.
Yes, they are.
So what do you do when the economy's squishy like it's been, and you have to sell a $500 pair of boots?
Boots are anywhere from $100 to $1,000 a pair.
Wow, really?
But I've been around for 30 years. I've seen ups and downs.
Yeah.
And I have my own theory.
Hit me.
Okay. It's real simple. When you're not buying washing machines, you're not buying cars, you're not buying houses, you're not buying things like that, you need to feel good. Boots make your feet happy.
Does it give you guys, and I speak Texans broadly, it gives you a little bit of that Texas in your step, right? I mean, it does.
It makes you taller in the saddle, that's for sure.
Yeah. that's a whole different kind of radio show.
Yeah, I know.
Right? I don't know. Talk to me about the international business. I mean, you're selling a lot of these in Asia, right?
Asia, yes. Actually, Asia is one of our larger markets. Basically, we have a Chippewa brand that basically is a lifestyle. It's an everyday boot. It competes against Red Wing. But also, we have Justin that goes overseas. Tony Lama's sold a lot in Japan. It's a favorite cowboy boot. It's a high-end boot, but it's loved over there. And actually, we sell a lot of work boots. We sell a lot of work boots overseas in Canada, and we sell them down in Central America. In other places, and also a little company called Nakona.
Should I know them? I don't know.
No, it's just one of five.
You know what else? They make you taller. They give me like 1.5 inches.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm checking these out. Justin used to be family-owned, reasonably small. It's been bought since by Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Does that change things? I mean, what does that do?
Not much. It was. Justin family had the business for a long time. It was a public company in 2000 when Warren bought it. And, the beauty of Berkshire, they basically leave you alone to run your business.
Yeah.
They truly are. He leaves you with your autonomously there to run it, and we run it.
Did you make a special pair for Mr. Buffett?
Yes. Matter of fact,
they were probably not the machine stitch kind, were they?
No, there were some handmade ones. But the interesting boots for Mr. Buffett was Nakona, which does college boots.
Yeah.
They have nice, he has some Cornhusker boots.
There you go.
Yeah, so he's into that. So he's, you know.
All right, I got about a minute left, which means I have to take these boots off. But let me ask you a question about actually the politics and the economics of these boots. I mean, do you see people in this economy making these discretionary purchases as they're trying to figure out what to do in a soft economy?
Yeah, a lot of them are made for need. You know, some of the purchases, obviously the work boots are a need item and so on. It's a great barometer for us on the economy. It tells us what's going on where in a lot of ways. But you know.
So, all right, so tell me where the economy's going.
Well, the economy in some areas is getting better. You know, it was horrible down in Alabama, Florida, Ohio, places like that, Missouri. Things are beginning to turn in some states.
Yeah. Amazing. These are good. The first pair of boots I ever had on, by the way. First pair of cowboy boots.
Now,
now I got to give them back.
Yeah, I know. That's okay. I brought them for you to try on.
Herb Beckwith, the CFO and Senior VP International at Justin Brand. Herb, thank you so much for playing on your sports. Appreciate it. I got here about, 6 hours ago. Didn't take me 10 minutes, though, driving in from the airport to get my first hint of all the things that are happening here in Dallas. Seems like this whole place is under construction. You got cranes on the skyline right and left out there. You guys are nodding, right? I'll tell you, so it's probably a pain for you guys, but it's cool to see coming in because that doesn't happen in every city in this country. People are talking recovery here. You guys have building after building going up, which is another way of saying jobs. Among those jobs are architects like Lorena Toffer. She is with Cargan Associates. Last year was named Dallas Young Architect of the Year, and she's right here with us. Hi Lorena, how are you?
Hi, guys.
So first of all, tell me what you're working on. What are you doing to help build this Dallas now?
Well, you just walked over one of our projects, the ones that I'm working with Cargan Associates right now, that DFW Airport.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. It's going through a 7-year program. They call it a Terminal Renewal and Improvement Program. So it's going to take 7 years to basically upgrade all of the systems and the spaces for all terminals in the airport.
Are you guys busy at Cargan Associates? I mean, is architecturing busy here in Dallas?
We are. I think, you know, we are recovering. It's a slow recovery, however. Yeah. We haven't been hit as hard, but still, I think, you know, my colleagues and at different architectural firms, they do feel the impact of the recession.
Yeah, I bet. You are the co-chair of Latinos in Architecture Committee of the Dallas chapter of the American Institute of Architects. This is, as we've been talking about, a political year. Latinos are a sought-after group, Latino professionals especially. What's it like to be in that group? I mean, do you feel wanted, for want of a better phrase? You know, I'll tell you what. In California, they don't want me at all, man. They don't want me at all. They like completely discount me.
Well, it's a very exhilarating place to be right now.
Yeah.
Just to give you just a broad idea, there's 5% of architects that are members of AIA in Dallas that are Latino in background, and about 15% of them are women. So.
Wow.
With 2,000 members that we have in our chapter, you know, that can make a very big impact. So we're taking it very seriously to engage that group, and for the most part, you know, to let others know about the talent that's there and how we can keep improving our built environment.
Yeah, and the other part is you said there are a high proportion of women, but I imagine in architecture at large, you guys want more women in there, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, there's about almost 50% of women in architecture school, but from that 50, only about 50% are really, you know, in that profession, truly engaged, and from that percentage, it's even smaller number of us that are either associates or partners or owners of a firm.
Yeah. When you go to a cocktail party and people see that you're a young Latina and you describe yourself as an architect, what's their reaction? I mean, what do people say?
They get engaged in the conversation very quickly. You know, they really want to know what projects I'm working on or how the industry is changing. And I tell them that, you know, it's no secret that the demographics in our region and in our nation are changing. And so does have to change, you know, the way we have been doing business.
Right. And there are probably mentoring programs for you and for younger female architects in your profession as well, right?
There are. Yeah. The AIA is, you know, quite they keep us very actively engaged in all these programs to mentor us and for us also to take an active role in our communities, be role models for the youth that's coming.
Yeah. Do you feel that you are being accurately represented in what you see out there in political advertising, in the way that Latinas and Latinos and that community is playing in this election? Do you see that at all?
Well, I think, you know, it's a little bit hard to say because I'm very fortunate to be part of that group that was able to get an education, get a professional degree.
There's that education thing coming again, Patty and Mr. Fisher. I mean, right? Yeah. No, seriously.
Yeah, yeah. So that thing, that plays an important role in, you know, how they try to keep this stereotype.
Quickly, what's your next project after the airport?
I'm working on also, it's all airport related. I'm on the aviation team of Corgan Associates. So it's more airports.
Lorena Toffer is an architect at Corgan and more airports all the time. Co-chair of Latinos and Architecture Committee at the Dallas chapter of AIA. Lorena, thank you so much for coming by.
Appreciate it.
So for months, if not the past couple of years, we've been hearing about key issues like jobs and taxes and government spending, but what else is on y'all's minds out there? What is missing from the current political debate? Our next guests have some idea along those lines. BJ Austin is a reporter at KERA here in Dallas. Raul Magdaleno is an education consultant. He's a community activist as well. Thank you both for coming. Really appreciate it. BJ, we start with you. I notice you're wearing cowboy boots, though.
Yes, sir.
How about that?
Yes, sir.
How about that? Those are broken in, though.
They are. They have some miles on them.
I was slipping and sliding. I don't dance on stage usually. In your reporting, what are you seeing that's not making it actually out to air? I mean, what are the stories you see but you can't cover? There's so much.
One of them is education. We hear a lot about it in connection with jobs, more jobs, get Americans back to work, and we'll have the education programs to help them. But we had a passel of mayors come to Dallas recently.
You guys actually say that, passel?
Yeah.
I like that.
That's a lot, but not the whole. It's just a passel.
Okay.
It was the Opportunities and Jobs Task Force of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and they met here and issued a report of a study that they had commissioned that was pretty optimistic about job growth, but they were very pessimistic about qualified workers. Scott Smith, mayor of Mesa, Arizona, said that there are 3 million well-paid jobs going unfilled now because Americans aren't qualified for them. Their proposal is, well, they want Congress to get off the dime. They say Congress is pretty much all hat, no cattle when it comes to supporting education. That's what they said, honest. And they want the cities, they want Congress to not, for God's sake, don't cut the funding, but increase it. And they want each mayor to get involved with their school districts directly to try to bring the business communities in to fill a gap.
Let me bring Raul in here. You are a community activist, you're an education consultant. When you go out and make this pitch to mayors, leaders, civic groups, do you feel like you're banging your head against the wall getting people to pay attention on this education issue?
Well, I think everyone has their own perception of what it's going to take to change education.
Yeah.
Some people say, you know, we need to become more involved. I think everyone values education. The question is, how do you do it?
Yeah.
How do you do it? And so I think. It's so multi-layered when we talk about education. Are we talking from K through 12? Are we talking about when we finally get them to college? And what we're noticing right now, the trend is there's some students going to college. However, retention, we work so hard to get them into school, and we finally get them into college, and then we drop them. Mm-hmm. We drop them, and then we're like, we worked so hard to build this, and here they are in college, but they cannot continue their education because of lack of resources. And particularly, I feel now that I've finally joined the middle class, I finally understand.
Hold that thought, because we got the middle class coming up in about 6 minutes. So maybe you're not really there. We don't know yet. We don't know yet. Don't start counting your chickens or whatever, you know. You know, it's really funny. So we've done, 4 of these shows, maybe 5 of them? Each city has a different thing that comes up as the main issue, but everybody has touched on education. everybody has touched on education. Why do you guys think that is? I mean, is it, I don't know, BJ, help me out.
It's your key. It's your ticket. It's your ticket to a job. And, you know, the world is basically run by HR. And in some cases, if you don't have that college degree, you're kicked out by the software. So it's, you know, it's tough out there, and you need every advantage you can get.
Raul, you know a little something about what it's like not to be in the middle class to try to pay for this education. I mean, give us the 30-second bio here, right? You know whereof you speak.
Absolutely. Well, when I was actually at SMU, I ended up living in a homeless shelter with my mother and my sister.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things that I don't brag about or say, you know, because it's something that is very shameful for me, it was. And it was something very difficult to live. And so many people say, well, you put yourself in that situation. I was like, I didn't. I had an elderly mother to support and a mentally disabled sister that I needed to support.
Yeah.
And so here I was living in a homeless shelter. And when I went to go ask for Section 8 housing, I said, I'm not asking for help, Section 8 housing. I'm just asking, please give me a hand. And they said, because you're in college, you do not qualify to live in Section 8. I said, I promise, if I ever get that opportunity, I will give you back government. I will quadruple whatever you invest in me. And I travel all over the country, Kai, and I cannot tell you how many single mothers, how many students I have that are homeless college students right now living in this country that we call America, and no one is talking about it. And because they are going to college, they do not qualify for government assistance. And that is where I strongly disagree with our Democrat brothers and sisters, because, you know, I'm an independent. But I say, you know, why don't we give the tools needed? Let's push them up. Let's bring that community up to where they need to be. And so that's something I'm extremely passionate about.
Hold that thought. Let's get your questions in here. We'll see if we can squeeze two. And I'm going to go real quick. You have to come to the microphones, though, because if you don't, I can't call on you. Why aren't then we hearing more about this issue? If it's come up in every city we've been in, if it's come up in all kinds of discussions and forums, BJ, why aren't we hearing more about it?
Well, everybody's for education, but the problem is how to pay for the programs.
Yeah.
Decide what to do and then how to pay for it. Last legislative session, Texas lawmakers cut $5 billion from education.
$5 billion in California happens every third Tuesday.
Honest
to Pete, it really does. Honest to Pete, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we do. That's true. And the government spends it. Sir, tell us who you are and where you're from.
I'm John. I live near McKinney. Do y'all feel like the universities and colleges actually have the right curriculum to prepare people for jobs today?
Ro, what do you think? That's a good question.
No. No. I
elaborate.
I'm afraid to say that. Well, one of the things is that we're so focused on a lot of the external, you know, you have to do this amount of geometry or what have you. We need to do more practical. What is it? What did we learn in college that we actually begin to apply to the real life experience? And at the school that I used to work at SMU, the Meadows School of the Arts, I actually had a very innovative dean that I had the honor of working with. He said, use the art, because especially for musicians, people who are in the arts, how are you going to find a job afterwards? He was able to say, how do you use your art to make a difference in the world? And so he was able to transform. So every summer, the students have to go and study abroad and say, how can I use my artwork to make a difference around the world and not just sell coffee at Starbucks?
Yeah. So quickly, sir, if you would.
Christian Yosden Pond from Dallas, Texas. What's the social responsibility that the private sector has to creating educational opportunities for young people?
BJ, that one's yours.
I think it's an incredible investment and opportunity.
I do wish Mr. Fisher was still here, right? That'd be a good question.
Yeah, they really need to do that. Our mayor has partnered with the chamber, and he has invited all corporations to pony up to get in the schools and actually get their fingernails dirty and mentor kids and promote programs.
BJ Austin from KERA, Raul Magdalena, thank you very much, guys. I appreciate you coming on. Coming up, something you hear about from President Obama and Governor Romney all the time, the middle class. We'll tell you the real story of what middle class really means. And you can't come to Dallas without talking about food. We'll look at a small business and food over the past 4 years. All that coming up on the Marketplace. No horse, no race, election roadshow. Stick around. There have been, by my very rough count, something like a zillion sound bites through the course of this campaign, and with only 21 days left until the election, the candidates have been talking about anything and everything that they think will resonate with voters, including the things that might affect the broadest chunk of Americans. Listen to this.
Middle-class families.
The middle class of America.
The middle class.
The middle class.
The middle class. But who exactly are they talking about? Yes, we know the middle class is somewhere between rich and poor. That's why we call it the middle. Just a bit more specific, if you like, between $39,000 plus or minus and $118,000 a year for the typical household. But that's a big range, and it's also just the numbers. When it comes to almost everything else, jobs and lifestyles and attitudes, depending on who's doing the talking, middle class can mean a whole lot of different things. So to help answer the question of just what the middle class is and where it's come from, we've got Chrissy Clark here on stage with us. She is a senior reporter at our Wealth and Poverty Desk at Marketplace. And to judge by all those shopping bags, Chrissy, what, you've been shopping?
Right. I was in Dallas. I heard there was really good shopping in Dallas, right?
All right. I guess. I just got a pair of boots. That's all I know about.
No, okay. So this is really why I went shopping. Right. So I figured before I get to the politicians' definitions of what middle class is, we are a democracy. I should go to the people. So we went out onto the street to ask people around the country, including here in Dallas, what it takes to be middle class. I did some shopping based on that list, and I have all the stuff in these bags.
I'm sorry, you have the definition of middle class in a bunch of shopping bags.
I do.
All right, hit me, man.
Okay, so perhaps the number one thing people said you need to be middle class is one of these.
You got a job.
A good paying job.
Work. It
brings home a decent wage.
All right, so you got a paycheck. I get it. Very good. Clever.
Yes. And so you also probably need to own one of these.
House.
Home. Roof over your head.
All right, a little house.
I've got one here for you. It's a little small, it's cozy.
Not a Texas ranch.
I feel like this one is a little dated, but people also said you still probably should have one of these.
White picket fence.
No, you have a white picket fence in a bag, all right? White picket fence.
I made it.
Got it.
Let's see. What else have we got in here? Okay, you need some of these.
Some kids, maybe one or two kids.
A vacation a year. Credit card.
May have a dog.
Woof.
Woof, woof.
Good.
And I thought that this one was really cool. You also need some of this.
Freedom to spend time with my loved ones and not have to work a second job.
The Statue of Liberty torch and the crown thing. Got it. Very good.
Yes. So I thought that was a really nice one. But back to those jobs that last woman was talking about, that's where things get a little bit tricky, because what exactly is a middle class job?
White collar.
Doctor. Lawyer.
As well as blue collar.
Police, fire, teachers.
Skilled trades.
Auto worker.
And from there, things start to get even harder to pin down. For example, people agreed that a middle class family definitely needs
car.
But how many? What kind?
Two cars.
Not a brand new car.
Maybe buy a car every couple years.
And then take education. Also a huge range of options.
High school diploma.
College degree.
In fact, people couldn't really agree on even just the basic philosophy of what it means to be middle class. Is it this?
The ability to provide the necessities of life.
Bag of what? Are those ramen noodles?
Yes, necessities of life.
Good. Got it.
Or is it this?
Able to buy things not because they need to, but because they want to.
Okay, wait, stop. Okay.
Aren't these cute?
What's with the shoes on the broadcast today? We got boots, and now we got these crazy shoes. All right.
Here's the thing.
I'm a little confused, right? We're not even at the politics of this thing yet. I'm just baffled.
Right, and Kai, that's because it is confusing. Part of why is because right now, as we speak at this moment in history, the definition of the middle class is changing. And it's not just because of the Great Recession. It's deeper economic forces that are at work. People are worried.
It's like middle class is disappearing.
It ain't but rich and poor right now.
There's really no in between.
It's not what it used to be, basically.
And a lot of the things that we took for granted about what the middle class means, people feel that those things swept away.
Got it. Whoa. Look out, Herb. Look out. All right, I get it. Swept
okay?
away, right? I get that thing. Bye-bye middle class as we knew it. But let me ask you something. And can we play that last woman, Jeff, real quick?
It's not what it used to be, basically.
So what did it used to be, right? I mean, the stereotype is 1950s, white picket fence as you had, 1.3 kids and a dog, the whole deal. What's the truth about what the middle class is in this country and where it came from?
Well, it's funny that you should ask me, Kai, about the history of the middle class, because I happen to have brought with me a little thing that I call...
Great moments in middle class history. A PowerPoint presentation.
PowerPoint on the radio. All right, good.
So... Are you guys ready? Let's begin. Oh, yeah. Okay, going way, way back, one of the first references to the middle class by an American was Thomas Paine, who in 1792 wrote...
A poll tax was levied. It excited, as it naturally must, universal detestation among the poor and middle classes.
I thought that it was kind of funny that even back then, the middle class stereotype was someone annoyed by taxes.
That's great.
But the middle class that Paine was talking about does not look like you might expect. It's not white collar or blue collar. Back then, the middle class looked like this.
The yeoman farmer.
That's writer Michael Lind. He wrote a book about the economic history of the United States called Land of Promise. And he says, once upon a time, our founding fathers realized that if they were actually going to make this crazy idea of a democracy work, they needed something that didn't really exist yet anywhere in the world.
A dominant middle class who, because of a certain amount of economic security and economic independence, is capable of playing various roles that society in a republic demands, whether it's as a voter or as a juror.
And since there were a lot of farmers running around back then, they seemed like good candidates for the job. But Lind argues these guys didn't just naturally become economically independent and secure. What you might call America's first middle class didn't just happen. It came about through a series of choices we made as a country.
An artificial creation of private sector and public sector policies, distribution of federal land to farmers through the Homestead Act, elementary public education.
Things that America kind of invented to help support this new middle class idea.
So, Chrissy, what happened to the farmer version of the middle class?
Well, you may remember from history class, by the late 1800s, new technology and machines meant we needed fewer farmers. The rest headed to factories and cities where conditions weren't so great. And to say the least, they weren't getting paid a whole lot. And as Americans watched this yeoman farmer ideal kind of unravel before their eyes, they started freaking out. Like, what is happening to the middle class that we built this country on?
Which is today, right? I mean, this is what we're hearing now.
Exactly. And so back then, Lind says in response, a lot of thinkers on the left and the right and the center said, we have to do something. Not just because it seemed like a nice idea, but because people had this theory.
A stable democracy requires a dominant middle class. If you had a desperate, low-wage majority that lacked property, that lacked any stake in society, they would turn to demagogues.
So the next American experiment was to figure out a way to bring those low-wage factory workers into the middle class fold. And Michael Lind says that required a whole new set of public and private policies, things like Henry Ford's $5 workday.
Labor unions, minimum wage laws, minimum hours laws, the GI Bill, the home mortgage financial system where the government backed low-interest loans to create the first mass middle class of homeowners in human history.
And voila, a new version of the middle class was born.
So you fast forward to today, though, right? And what you have is a need for fewer and fewer factory workers, better technology, globalization, things moving overseas, the changing global economy, right?
Right. And Lind argues that we're actually at a very similar moment right now to that moment 100 years ago when we were shifting off the farms. There's kind of this void where the bulk of the middle class used to be. We haven't quite figured out how to fill it, and there's a lot of anxiety again.
Okay, so you know this is the election roadshow, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's get it back to that whole election thing and the two guys we started with and this idea they have of the middle class. What do the president and Governor Romney have to say about what they want to do to help the middle class?
So, of course, each guy kind of wants to let you think that they're talking about you when they're talking about saving the middle class. But there are clues to how each of them see it. Obama really focuses on the importance of education.
Education was the gateway to opportunity for me. It was the gateway for Michelle. It was the gateway for most of you. And now, more than ever, it is the gateway to a middle-class life.
As for Romney, he focuses, not surprisingly, on small businesses.
We will champion small businesses, America's engine of job growth. That means reducing taxes on business, not raising them. It means simplifying and modernizing the regulations that hurt small business the most.
All right, so spitball this for me. Is there a way, Chrissy, to figure out which one of these guys is right?
Well, Michael Lynn, the guy that we heard from earlier, has a pretty provocative answer to that that kind of throws everything up in the air.
Conservatives tend to recommend entrepreneurialism. Progressives tend to want to expand the number of people who go to college. The problem is the math simply does not work.
And Lind means the math on both sides. On the one hand, he points out that only about 10% of Americans are self-employed. On the other hand, 70% of Americans don't have college degrees.
I'm sorry, 70%?
Yes, wow. it's a big number. So as wonderful as the ideals of education and entrepreneurship may be, neither of those trends are going to change overnight. So Lind worries that in the meantime, no party is being really realistic about the bulk of Americans who won't be small business owners or white-collar professionals.
Well, there's got to be, it can't be one from column A and one from column B, right? What do you do if nobody fits in there?
So Lind and a lot of economists say that at least for the foreseeable future, most of the jobs will be ones that involve something like this.
The broom again. Okay, work with me.
Right, what? So we're talking jobs in the service sector. Janitors, home health care workers, restaurant servers. And Lind says the trick is going to be how to turn those kinds of jobs into middle-class jobs.
Yeah, but you know what? You've done the reporting on these stories. You know this stuff. You know exactly what I'm going to say. Those aren't the jobs that in this economy are the most desired, most celebrated, certainly not the best paid.
Right, as one of the women in our audience just pointed out. And in fact, each time the country has shifted from one economic sector to the next, Americans have felt that way.
Farmers in the early 19th century looked down on factory work. A century later, the factory worker on the assembly line becomes the symbol of the new middle class. There's a lot of fear now that the jobs of the future will be degrading and demeaning, and it's a genuine challenge to upgrade jobs which today tend to be very poorly paid and to be without benefits.
But Lind says that if we really want to be thinking about the future of the middle class, that's what we should be talking about this election.
Yeah, but here we are, 21 days from the election. How many people who go to vote or who have already voted early are thinking about the middle class when they go into the voting booth?
Right, or thinking about the middle class in that way. I don't know. I would be curious here in the audience how many of you are thinking about it
in that
way.
We have one guy shaking his head, three people raising their hands. Really? All right, so then what does that mean? I mean, where do we find the thing that's going to resonate with people on this one?
Well, I think it's up to voters to put those sorts of questions to whoever gets elected in terms of what it really means. It can't just be a soundbite.
Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Chrissy, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
with the sweep up thing, is that what you're doing, right? With the broom again? Yes. All right, let's get you going. Okay, let me slide this one a little bit. Perfect. She does it all, Chrissy Clark, ladies and gentlemen. A moment now for a snack, if we might, a treat of sorts. Fernando Luna Sr. and his son, Fernando Jr., run Luna's Tortillas here in Dallas. My guess is you guys have probably heard of them. The Luna family The Luna family has been making tortillas since 1924, 88 years, for those of you trying to do the math quickly, and they have managed to keep both the business and the tortilla recipe in family hands all that time. Gentlemen, welcome and thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
First of all, how's business?
Business is good.
Is it good for like recession good or is it good?
Business is recession good.
Okay. Okay. Expand on that a
June,
little bit.
June, July, August is always our down months of the year. I don't know if it goes.
How come?
Well, maybe it's just summertime. Everybody's out on vacation. Maybe it's too hot to be eating Mexican food all the time. We like to think.
But as soon as the cool weather
comes, as soon as the first football game kicks off, as soon as Halloween's around the corner, it just picks up 100%.
Who knew? All right, so Fernando Jr., what's in the bag, man?
A little snack for you, something for you
come
to try
on,
out today.
Come on, give it up.
We got some nacho chips, some hot sauce, and of course, as well as Luna's Tortillas, we do handmade from scratch tamales.
Oh, my goodness.
Big tradition in Texas.
That's awesome.
Now.
This is good. We're going to have a little post-show feast, but let me ask you, Fernando Sr., what has business been like the past 4 years?
Past 4 years, we went into a move that we have not moved in 83 years. We had our business was here, 7 blocks away on McKinney Avenue.
Yeah.
So we sold that property as a family, decided to move out on Harry Hines at 8524.
Yeah.
And naturally, you're always leery if the public's going to follow you.
Yeah.
Thank goodness the city of Dallas has responded well to us.
I'm just going to snack. Sorry.
In the changing of the movement, we lost one customer, wholesale customer, that decided to go elsewhere for his tortillas. But really, we hadn't seen a bit of change. Matter of fact, our retail is better now where we are.
These are good. They're spicy all by themselves a little bit, right?
They shouldn't
be. Don't you think?
They shouldn't be.
So you know what it is?
That's
you know what it is, actually? I'm used to California tortillas. And clearly, we don't. Come on, give me a break. Did you hear Mr. Fisher talking about small businesses and how they're the root of job creation here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so how are you guys going to do it?
Wow.
I mean, no pressure, but right? I mean, you had the president of the Dallas Fed saying, you're it. So hit me.
You know what? We've started, hopefully. Maybe we didn't realize what we were doing, but after 88 years of business and something that my great-grandmother and my grandfather started, we expanded. We opened up our first restaurant. After providing restaurants wholesale, we opened up our first restaurants last year, about a year and a half ago, employed another 15 to 20 people. In doing so, we realized that we have a responsibility to those employees, you know, to be there every day, that we created jobs or that we helped the economy.
You need to do more radio, by the way. You sound really good.
Thank you.
Well, pick up on that thread, though, about hiring people and creating jobs. You know, the debate in Washington is always, how are we going to get companies to create more jobs? Are we going to give them tax breaks? Are we going to incentivize them? What's going to make you hire more people or your dad if he gets to decide? Who gets to decide?
Final decision. Yeah. But yeah, incentives to create more job opportunities, to expand, to create more business opportunities.
Yeah.
That's something that's actually new for us, something we're looking for, something that we want to expand upon because all of a sudden being ingrained a little bit more in the family business, I see and I've come across those taxes now, something I didn't used to have to be a part of every day when I was working in corporate America. But, you know, being with my father in the family business, I see all those numbers.
You left corporate America to come back and work with your dad.
I was in California for 10 years. I loved it. But this is home. This is Texas. My family, friends came back home to join the family business. And again, hopefully when I came home, Dad said, well, let's expand. Yes, there's taxes. Yes, there's obligations that we have to fulfill, and we were talking about it. There's other things that we have to do that are set in stone, or not in stone, but structured by the government, society, policies, whatnot, but it's not going to prohibit us from continuing to expand or do something different or something that we love to do, which is customer service in the end.
Fernando Sr., let me ask you this, and it's the last question of the night. What is it about small business in America? Because there's something, right?
It's in your heart.
Yeah.
In our case, the company is 88 years old. We were born into the business. You come to learn the business. You don't realize it when you're a young age. But as you get a little bit more mature, you get married, you have children, and start sending them to school, it's in your blood.
Fernando Luna, senior and junior from Luna's Tortillas. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
All right, we got to go. That is the Marketplace. No horse, no race, election roadshow. Devin Maverick Robbins produced our program with help from Bridget Bodner. Nancy Fargali is the roadshow producer. Our engineer is Jeff Peters sitting back there. Special thanks today to Jeff Whittington and Jeff Ramirez and the entire staff here at KERA and the great audience here in Dallas. For us, the executive producer of Marketplace is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. You can check our website, marketplace.org, for more on everything you heard here tonight. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thank you so much for being with us.